from this fresh grave. My face was hot and stinging. My skin felt loose, like it was sliding off my skull. We still had to perform. Nearly 45 minutes late, we walked onto the stage, not looking at one another, our Belgian promoter stupefied but polite. I played the whole set looking down, feeling like an outline of myself, trying to make my shape familiar to the audience, to the onlookers, since I had no sense of my body at all. I didn't talk, smile, look. Staying put was all I had. Halfway through the set, I realized that no one could tell, that the difference between half-dead and distraught and fully living could potentially go undetected. And that's when I knew I wanted to stop. I was done. I had dragged Slater Kinney into oblivion, a place we used to get to with our music. I took us there with hurt. When we walked off stage and returned to the dressing room, everything had changed. Colors and shapes, nothing was the same. It was a planetary shift, a foreign sphere that only hours before had signified total familiarity. I knew right then and there that the band was done. Corin wanted my father to come get me, but we kept going. We had another week or so of shows. The tension was palpable. The nights were joyless. No one trusted me. The band gave me my own hotel room so that I could sleep. I would lie in bed at night and talk to my dad. With the time difference, he was at his office. It was the same feeling I had of swimming with him as a child. I clung to him. But I felt misshapen, lost. I couldn't locate myself on any map, in anyone's world, least of all my own. Tour ended. We flew home and planned our last shows. We wrote a brief letter to the fans that we put on our website. We called what we were about to embark on a hiatus, as if it were a painless, bloodless pause. We have not talked about that night in Brussels since. Chapter 19. Be Still This Sad Year. When we returned from tour, we all felt broken. Each of us had something that wasn't working anymore. The only reason we had kept doing Slater Kinney year after year was because the rewards outweighed the amount of work and the difficulties, the heartbreak and the frustrations. But we had reached a point where the cracks couldn't easily be filled, assuaged, or mitigated by a great live show. The damage felt transparent. The larger truth was that Corin was also tired of touring, conflicted about leaving her family, feeling a disconnect between wanting to provide comfort to a child while sitting in the constant discomfort of a musician's life. I started seeing a psychiatrist who put me on medication for anxiety and depression. I apologized. I tried to make amends with the band. After the shame of what I'd done came a kind of relief. Janet and Corin and I reached something close to peaceable for the remaining tour dates. We tried to view them as celebratory. We'd always come home from tours exhausted. We'd had fights during the Dig Me Out and Hot Rock tours that were immense compared to any squabbles we'd had since. We'd been a band for 10 years. With the Woods, I felt that we had accomplished a great deal, pushed ourselves as far as we could go at that point. We had succeeded in redefining our own identity, our own music, reigniting the imaginations of music fans and what people thought we were. It would have been difficult to continue on without a struggle. It seemed like the journey had run its course. We ended the band at the best time we could, when people really wanted us to stay. If we had been more calculated or had stronger management, maybe we would have strategized the end differently, made an announcement, put a final tour on sale, so everyone who wanted to could come and see us one last time. But that wasn't really the way that it was. Nothing felt celebratory. We didn't want to run a victory lap, especially since it felt like we'd left the race prematurely. Certainly someone with more business acumen might have been able to capitalize on the end of Slater Kinney. Instead, we had some East Coast shows already booked as warm-ups for Lollapalooza. When we made the announcement on our website about the impending indefinite hiatus, Those shows suddenly carried more weight and meaning. The final show in New York at Webster Hall was not our best. We had hired a film crew thinking we should capture some of these performances, maybe put out a DVD. By now we felt very confident in our live show, nimble, commanding, powerful. For the Woods tours, we had brought along the lighting director, Stan Eliflot. He lives on the islands in the Puget Sound and has a long shock of white hair, dreadlocks forming sporadically, part Scandinavian hipster, part drifter, very gentle. Like any good LD, he helped the audience hear the music through visuals. Yet for some reason, we let the film crew dictate the lights for the Webster Hall show. They claimed that they needed the lighting to be very bright, very static. It was lit like a dressing room in a department store. Everything was on. My hair shrank from the moisture alone. I could feel it getting smaller and smaller, tighter on my head. Meanwhile, my shirt was completely soaked through. I could barely play from the sweat dripping down my arms and hands. It was turning into a completely aquatic experience. Even during the performance, I was aware of how awful this footage would look, and that we should never put out the DVD unless we included a sticker on the cover that said something to the effect of, "Hey, the three ugliest women in America have been in a band for the past 10 years. Have you seen them?" Here we were playing a city that had always been generous and welcoming to us, one we looked up to, aspired and strived to deserve and impress. But we turned Webster Hall into a veritable tanning salon. The footage was entirely unusable. Like many aspects of our career, it nearly worked. It almost succeeded. That could be our band biography, Almost, by Slater Kinney. Then in D.C., a heat wave hit. At the 9:30 club, the generator went out. No power, no air conditioning. Fans had driven from all along the eastern seaboard, as far away as Florida, for this gig, taken days off work. Panic and stress set in. Even if we rescheduled the show in a few days, would these people be able to come back? We ended up flying to Chicago, playing Lollapalooza, and then returning to D.C. Each show started to feel like a countdown. We would start playing the songs, especially ones like Call the Doctor or Little Babies, tunes we'd been playing for over 9 years, and I would realize that this might be one of the last times I ever played these songs. The feeling was heavy, but I didn't want to think about how it might be perceived from the outside. It seemed crucial to stay in the moment, to feel our way through those last shows, to enjoy them. Except for scheduling a final show in Portland, we didn't formalize a way for fans to say goodbye. We wanted to go out in a way that acknowledged our history, and that was also respectful to ourselves and to the fans, but we didn't want to feel like a museum piece, to apply some kind of unnecessary or self-aggrandizing gravity to the situation. We were a band. We were here, and then we weren't. In August, we played our final 2 shows. We added a second when the first instantly sold out, in Portland. Tickets were $12, our typical price. People traveled from around the world to see us out. It was flattering and bittersweet. We rehearsed for our last 2 shows in a minuscule practice space inside a facility shared with countless other Portland bands. Windowless, with dirty, blotted walls, our amps set up facing one another, the drums within arm's reach, we were a cluster, a huddle. You start in a tiny room and you end in one too. Just me and Corin and Janet and a decade of songs between us. We had played those songs for thousands upon thousands of people. But now, as at the beginning, we would play them for only each other. We ran through the proposed set list. We would draw from the entirety of the catalog, which was common for our live show, though we often favored the most current album. This time, however, we wanted to highlight our favorites, the songs dearest to us, the ones to which our fans felt closest. The only moment that acknowledged the weight of the situation was when we played Jumpers, the song about suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge, a song I had written during a bout of depression. The middle section of the song goes like this. Be still this old heart, be still this old skin, drink your last drink, sin your last sin. Sing your last song, about the beginning, sing it out loud, so the people can hear. Be still the sad day. Be still the sad year. Hope your last hope. Fear your last fear. I could barely get the words out. When we finished the song, Corin and I were both crying. It's when and how I said my own goodbye. August 12th, 2006. The backstage at the Crystal Ballroom, a historic Portland venue where the band had played some of our biggest and best hometown shows, was both celebratory and funereal. There were flowers and champagne, friends and family. We took pictures and warmed up, stretched and dressed, conferred on the set list, visited with old friends, caught a few minutes of the opening acts we'd asked to play. Our moms and dads and siblings wore our concert t-shirts from throughout the years. It was a dizzying, glorious parade, but also like watching someone put your life behind museum glass. You could feel the air being sucked out of the room, of the band, of your body. The second-to-last show had an incredible crowd. It was the biggest mosh pit I had seen in years. The whole floor was moving, vibrating as a single organism. For the final show, Eddie Vedder came down from Seattle to give us a send-off. One of the most caring and soulful people I've ever met, he took the stage before we did, just like he had on all those nights we opened up for Pearl Jam. He stood up there in front of our crowd this time, ukulele in hand, and said that he'd always wished he had been able to see the Beatles or Led Zeppelin in their prime, or Keith Moon play with The Who, but that he felt lucky to have seen Sleater-Kinney. In one sentence, he summed up for me what so many critics and pundits missed every time they put modifiers on our music, on our identity as a band. All we ever wanted was just to play songs and shows that mattered to people, that mattered to us. Music that summed up the messiness of life, that mitigated that nagging fear of hopelessness, loneliness, and death. That night we played for a roomful of the people who understood that very thing. Once again, I felt privileged, lucky. The final show was more contemplative, slightly maudlin. There was a lot of pressure on the two performances for them to somehow, impossibly, be the summation of our entire career as a band. But there was so much about Sleater-Kinney, about the three of us, that was never sung or said or played at those final performances. I mentioned from the stage that this band had saved my life over and over again, and I think that is true. When we finished the final show, there wasn't any real closure. It just felt like it always does, the three of us trying to pass something on to the crowd, hoping it was good enough. Part 3. Aftermath. Chapter 20. Shelter. People always ask me if I was sad when Sleater-Kinney broke up. Mostly, I felt a sense of relief. My grief was on hold, my emotions compartmentalized and transferred. The band was a phantom limb. I could still feel it there. I didn't really believe that it was gone, but mostly I ignored it. In a small room on the second floor of my house, a former attic built out by the previous owners, with slanted ceilings and corners only accessible by crawling, I placed a striped wool rug, a guitar, and a lone amplifier. The only time I entered the room was to pet my cat, Hector, who often sat in there atop a carpeted cat condo and watched over the contents of the space like a furry museum guard. Instead of playing or thinking about music, I dove into my volunteer work at the Oregon Humane Society, which is just about the only way I knew how to deal with the loss. If you're wondering how sad I was, you'd never know by talking to me, but you would know it by the fact that I won the Oregon Humane Society Volunteer of the Year Award in 2006, the year of Sleater-Kinney's demise. I clocked in over 100 hours that year. I developed new programs to help long-term canine shelter residents get adopted. I made laminated flyers replete with photos I took of the dogs and added pat, inspirational, and euphemistic phrases like, "If you love a toothy kiss, you'll love Buster," to promote specific dogs. I walked them on the shelter grounds and even took them on field trips. I taught the more rambunctious dogs to sit, wait, go to their bed, how to walk better on the leash. I sat in the lobby wearing my teal volunteer apron with two large front pockets gritty with dog treat remnants, torn and gooey from overeager puppy mouths, stretched from too much wear and not enough washing. I greeted customers in the lobby, grateful to be in a uniform, just one of many, anonymous and near invisible, in a place where frumpiness and depression thrive. The dogs I brought with me to the lobby were my interlocutors, my translators. They bounded up to customers, and I channeled their optimism. They lived in the moment, grateful for the interaction, and so was I. I had a purpose, even if part of that purpose was hosing down feces-covered kennels. The dogs' needs seemed simple, and I required simple needs, to have somewhere to be. It's easy to feel sated when all you're asking for in life is food, water, and some gentle petting. I befriended the older women who made up the majority of the other volunteers, retirees and former powerhouses in realms like consulting and finance, bored at home, sapped by stale marriages, with reticent or far-flung adult children and ill or dying friends. These women felt useful and appreciated. We formed a constellation of surrogates who likely should have been paying the dogs for therapy. It could have funded the entire shelter operation. We cried when dogs were euthanized, but also when they were adopted. We had been seeking comfort in the constant and could barely deal with change. The term shelter seemed to apply as much to the humans as it did to the animals. One's perspective on the number of animals it is appropriate to have within city limits changes when you're working at an animal shelter. To have no animals indicates that you're volunteering merely as a way of finding a pet to adopt, dabbling, putting you in a perennial state of searching, never to be taken seriously. Everyone waits for you to find your pet and then move on. Having merely one pet hints at a snootiness, as if your lifestyle is so refined, your abode so fastidious, your car so clean that only a single perfect creature will do. One dog or cat is more of an accessory. Most people who work with animals have at least two dogs or two cats or some combination thereof. But it is just as likely that a shelter worker or volunteer has four dogs and three cats and a rabbit, none of which get along, and a house set up like a kennel or boarding facility, with dog crates and baby gates, an upstairs-downstairs stratified dynamic, even going so far that spouses will sleep in separate rooms to accommodate the needs of the animals. These sacrifices and compromises are not seen as excessive, but rather valiant. After Slater-Kinney ended, Corin threw herself into being a full-time mom. Janet immediately found other bands with which to play, and I, under the influence of the Humane Society culture, started bringing home dogs, fostering one after another, seeking a perfect fit. I already had one dog, but I went ahead and adopted a second. Now I found myself with my own menagerie. There were four of them now, two cats and two dogs, one for each of my limbs. Enough of them so that I could evenly disperse my worries and obsessions among them. Worries that would have been too much for just one of them to bear. They were my family. We lived in my four-bedroom craftsman home in northeast Portland with a fake crow on the roof that I never stopped reminding people I didn't put up. It was a house big enough so that each of us could have had our own bedrooms if we'd wanted, and in a futile attempt to keep them off the furniture, there were in fact dog and cat beds everywhere but in the bathrooms. But instead we all chose to sleep in mine. At night, we vied for spots on the queen-size mattress, the cats my itchy neck warmers, one dog burrowing under the covers, the other in the crook of my knee. We were close enough that the exhalation of my breath made their ears twitch, that if one of them had fleas, we all did, so near and entwined that I couldn't tell one whisker-filtered snore from another. Despite the daytime chases and cross-species pestering and a scuffling of paws, the occasional annoyed meow or impatient whine, in the bed at night, we were all at peace. It was constricting, a fur coffin, but also a crib. If the fake crow were looking down on us, he would see a woman in her 30s, living alone, jobless and aimless, with animals to fill the space and to patch the holes. Leaving the house became a series of meticulous rituals. The ones for my own benefit were easy. Spend 2 minutes locating the keys, gather my wallet, lipstick, and gum, and place them in a cavernous bag, check my outfit in the entryway mirror, and leave. But the animals required so much more. Whenever I left, all I wanted to ensure was that I'd return to a space that was relatively the same as when I left. Sure, there would always be subtle changes, a couch pillow on the floor, the corner of it damp and freshly chewed, a shoe mysteriously moved from the entryway to beneath the coffee table, a rawhide half eaten, releasing into the house that fake smoke flavor that's supposed to appeal to animals, as if dogs and cats, back in their days in the wild, barbecued their meats. So before I would leave, I prepared. I thought ahead. I predicted behaviors that could be set off by boredom, loneliness, or sheer instinct. Like my record collection transforming into a 5-foot scratching post, or my books becoming mealy tug toys, I minimized risk. Step one, the big one, was to tire the dogs out. As I learned in my training classes, 85% of behavioral problems stem from lack of exercise. So we went on runs until their tongues fell out the sides of their mouths in a collapse of pink. Once home, the dogs would crash for hours. All the other steps came later, right before I walked out the door. Refresh the water bowls, leave out a few cat toys sprinkled with catnip, construct edible and impossible treats for the dogs that take them hours to eat, and finally, most important, rig the opening of the upstairs door with a piece of green garden twine, making a loop, leaving a gap just wide enough that the cats could slink through to the quiet and safety of upstairs, but too narrow for the big, boisterous dogs who had a tendency to get into the cat's personal space. Last, I would turn the radio on and say the words, "Be good, I'll be back." I said this to no one animal in particular, but to all of them, and to myself, and because it's something I'd want to hear even if someone never intended to come home. Hector, my first and oldest pet, was a 16-pound black cat with white details, a tuxedo cat with a chest broad and sturdy enough that I could lay my head upon it. He was a repressed and worried kitten when I got him at 8 weeks of age, too thoughtful for silliness like String. I named him after the Greek warrior to instill in him a sense of empowerment and duty. He grew into the name and took on the other definition of Hector, which is to bully. And when he was outdoors, he made sure the neighborhood cats understood the concept of property lines. Hector brought me presents from the outside world. Movie ticket stubs, old receipts, a parachute from a 4th of July firework, and he once retrieved his own collar, lost weeks before. He announced the arrival of each gift with a tiny, high-pitched meow, comically disproportionate to his girth, like a football linebacker reading poetry. I'd had him since I was 25. He had seen me through nearly a decade of living spaces, relationships, breakups, and tours, and when I called him my best friend, I was only half-joking. Poor Lyle, my second pet and second cat, always a sidekick, gray and white, with half a mustache, an endless supply of eye gunk, an acrobatic vertical jump that rivaled a pro basketballer, and a penchant for announcing himself when he walked into a room, which would have been fine except that he was always walking into rooms. Lyle was constantly getting into scrapes. He survived a collision with a pickup truck and walked away without a single broken bone, but with a tire tread across his face. He roamed around the neighborhood, crossed streets without looking both ways, tried to befriend a squirrel. He was stupidly, happily fearless, like a teenager on a dare. But he was also sensitive, particularly to my moods, absorbing my worry in his lithe little being. Whenever I moved cities or dwellings, Lyle would come down with gastritis. A plumbing disaster sent me into a rage when I bought my house in Portland, and immediately Lyle was back in the animal ER, not eating, vomiting up bile, and dramatic, spastic heaves. The vets never could find the underlying cause of his illnesses. I figured that Lyle was just checking himself into rehab. He needed a little break. He always came back from his vet stays rehydrated, rested, and ready to deal with me anew. Fortunately, both Lyle and I had Hector. Steady and unwavering, worthy and tolerant of the Andrew Sisters-style songs I wrote about him, like the one called Greatest Cuddler of All Time. Lyle and Hector spent much of their days locked in a yin-yang cuddle, Hector's fur matted and glossy from Lyle's diligent grooming. When I realized that in fact I was the cause of Lyle's stress with my anxieties and transferred hypochondria, it's not my fault that as a child, when I drank a few extra glasses of orange juice, my mom asked my dad if he thought I had diabetes, or that if I came home with more than one bruise on my leg, she suggested I had leukemia. The most logical solution for Lyle was to find ways of creating a calmer household. I could have learned to play the pan flute or taken up yoga or meditation, but I got a dog instead. After all, I needed to spread my worry among more vessels so that none would bear the brunt of it alone. Now I had a whole new species, one that demanded a lot more than my cats did. This was Toby, another boy, also another black and white, but bearded and wiry, some kind of pointer, and he quickly grew to 65 pounds of tightly coiled muscle. He mauled shoes and books. He stole rising pizza dough off the counter where it ballooned in his belly. He ate an entire bag of coffee beans. He side-tackled me at the river so hard it sent me to the ER. I was enchanted by his athleticism, even though all that made him agile made him potentially hurtful as well. It wasn't merely love. It was an adventure. If we measured our affection toward others by how many nicknames we bestow upon them, our pets would be the most loved. Here's the etymological journey for the nicknames I have for Toby. Tobito, Toblerone, T-Bone, T-Bonix, Tati, T-Tobes, Tubby for when he's gotten into the trash and gorged himself. Nicknames with origins based on appearance. Bearded Yum Yum, Handsome McHandsome, Fuzzy Face. Then this strange progression. Pooch, Poochers, Poocheroo, Poochacho, Poochoon. Then somehow Pooch turned into Mooch, and so there had to be Moocheroo, Muchacho, Manu, and most recently, Manunu. All these monikers I say in voices more commonly echoed from the confines of straitjackets and padded walls. Anyone we truly love should come with their own dictionary. Yet for all his strength and keen prey drive, Toby was afraid of Hector, whining and doing a little tap dance in the hallway because the cat wouldn't let him pass. He shared armchairs with Lyle during TV shows and movies, jealous that the cats could sit higher, jump higher, and most maddening, fit on my lap. We had struck a delicate but functional balance, a house with 14 legs and 4 hearts. It should have been enough. Here I was again without a family, my only identity a loner. A male loner is a hero of sorts, a rebel, an iconoclast, but the same is not true of a female loner. There is no virility in a woman's autonomy. There is only pity. I was floating. I had created my own abandonment. At the Humane Society, after a year of resisting the charms of countless puppy litters and special needs, blind, three-legged dogs without teeth, I fell in love with Joni Rose, a name better reserved for a twice-divorced aunt working a late shift in Reno than for a 5-month-old wrinkly-faced Sharpay mix with a circular bald patch on her nose. A fungus, they explained, or perhaps ringworm. I renamed her Olive to help bring out her cute side. She was my first female pet, a goofy brown nugget who communicated in a series of snorts and in yawns so big they emitted a whistle. Unlike Toby, she was easy to train, gentle and malleable. With Olive, I felt certain that I was done, complete. I had 2 pairs. Yet now the balance felt tipped. I was both the center of attention and the odd number. I was suddenly in the middle, with the cats on one side and the dogs on the other. Olive, with her puppy curiosity, was unafraid of the cats, and Toby's deference to them gave way to a newfound and sometimes alarming sense of empowerment. Thus, the departure rituals, the precautionary measures in the house, became more deliberate. An added cat door leading to the basement, a baby gate to keep the dogs out of certain rooms. The cat's realm became higher, more restricted, safer, or so I thought. One reason people get dogs is so there is always someone excited to see them when they get home. Whether I had been gone 5 hours or 5 minutes, Toby and Olive's greeting was the same. Effusive, sloppy, unabashed, a surprise party every time the key turned. It was my birthday, their birthday, Halloween and Christmas, confetti. On that warm July night in 2007, I knew something was wrong when I returned home, opened the front door, and no one came to greet me. No wags, no slobber, no clumsy collision of noses to knees. There was an acrid smell in the house, an airlessness in the entryway. I walked farther in. I saw that the green twine preventing the dogs from getting through the upstairs door was broken, the stairway exposed. Olive and Toby ran down. They were panting, wild-eyed, wet. I ran upstairs with the dogs at my heels. There were tufts of indistinguishable fur in the hallway, undercoat. I looked to the left into the music room. Here is where all the air in the house had gone, to give this ugliness breath and a brutal force. There was the crumpled rug, more fur, and the still black body of Hector. He lay next to my guitar, lifeless. I ran downstairs. I dragged the dogs out into the backyard like intruders, like garbage. I picked up the phone. I called friends, inarticulate with shock. I tried to sink into the walls. I tried to climb them. I bore my way into the couch. My house could not hold me. A friend came to take the dogs away because if they stayed, I said I would kill them. Yet I put together their dog food, carefully measuring out the servings in Tupperware containers, enough for a week, as if I were sending them away on vacation or to a summer camp. We wrapped Hector's body in a towel. I touched the tip of his tail, the white part that always looked like it had been dipped in paint. I held him. He was heavier than he'd ever been. We drove to the 24-hour animal hospital to have him cremated. It was the only time Hector didn't cry on the way to the vet. I returned home to an empty house. Lyle had been outside the entire time. I spent the next week sleeping downstairs on a lumpy futon mattress with Lyle, trying to get him to appreciate our time alone. He had all my attention. I brought out every cat toy. I put his food dish on the ground now that the dogs weren't around to steal from it. I bought him salmon-flavored snacks and played laser pointer until the batteries ran out. I wanted him to be sad, to miss Hector, to grieve, to comfort me. Mostly what I wanted was for Lyle to understand that for his own safety he would be rehomed to a friend, that these would be our last days together too. But like always, Lyle just wanted to be outdoors, and it became clear to me that we weren't looking at this in the same way. Humans and animals rarely do. There wasn't any blood. But when I could bring myself to return upstairs, it looked like a crime scene. The entire battle told in the deep, desperate scratches on the wood floor. It was clear that Hector had tried to hide under the bed. There had been a struggle in the hallway, and then finally in the music room, in that useless, sterile room that I kept as a mausoleum, a mourning I was ostensibly going to deal with when it was convenient, was a plain and sinister floor map upon which I could retrace every mistake I ever made. A body. A guitar. Now finally, I was sad. Here it was, that shadow that forms on your insides, a dark pooling, the grief. Everything I had was gone. Chapter 21. Home. Long ago, I stopped focusing on performing for the sake of my family, but instead performed in spite of it, away from it, to get out. The bottomless urge I had to entertain as a child had sent me headstrong and hurtling myself into rooms, hoping I'd arrive in time to delay or minimize the breakage. Cop, coach, clown, a one-girl Greek chorus there to protect, instruct, and delight. But there is no one I could really save but myself. That's what I mean when I say Slater Kinney was my rescue and salvation. It was the first time I felt I could be vulnerable in my creativity, in which the emotional and psychic stakes were neither futile nor self-annihilating. That unlit firecracker I carried around inside me in my youth, eager to ignite it at the slightest provocation, to detonate my whole being and fill the room in a glowing spectacle, found a home in music. My restlessness and unease was matched by my fellow miscreants, bandmates, collaborators, and audiences alike, but more crucially by a warmth and sustenance. In Slater Kinney, each song, each album built an infrastructure, fresh skeletons. These at last were steady bones. Now performing was no longer about trying to harness a cursory attention or to be a distraction. Slater Kinney allowed me to perform both away from and into myself, to leave and to return, forget and discover. Within the world of the band, there was a me and a not me, a fluctuation of selves that I could reinvent along the flight between perches. I could at last let go. For so long, I had seen the lacking I'd been handed as a deficit. My resulting anxiety and depression were ambient, a tedious lassoing of air. But with Slater Kinney, I stopped attempting to contain or control the unknown. I could embrace the unnamed and the in-between. I could engage in an unapologetic obliteration of the sacred. Singularities had always been foreign to me, and where and who I came from was rife with dualities, a mesh of conflicted and diluted selves attempting to cohere, failing on account of an inarticulate denial. Fortunately, music granted me both an allowance of and a continual engagement with the ineffable. I also, for once, felt a part of something. The inexplicable is its own form of freedom. Belonging is not a form of restriction. We can't name the feeling, but we can sing along. After we walked off stage at that final Slater Kinney show in 2006, we went to the dressing room. We drank champagne. There were toasts and cheers and hugs. Then we danced. On the second floor of the Crystal Ballroom is a smaller venue and bar called Lola's Room. While our friend DJed with 60s and 70s soul and funk, new wave and post-punk, we moved around the floor as a form of relief, of revelation, of love. As is so often the case, the night turned out to be less about the music we had played and more about who we had experienced the music with. When around 3 a.m. the club staff shut off the sound system and turned on the lights, we stayed on the floor for nearly a full 5 minutes, stomping our feet and clapping our hands, still dancing. We wanted more, to hear an echo, an encore of ourselves. Epilogue. In 2011, Fred Armisen and I were at Corin and Lance's house. We were sitting on a lumpy behemoth of a couch that the Tucker Bangs family called Mocha Chenille, showing them an early cut of a Portlandia episode that featured their son, Marshall. Out of the blue, Corin asked if I thought Slater Kinney would ever play again. The answer was obvious. We kept it a secret. Like when we traveled to the other side of the world in order to form our band. This time, we created a continent of whispers. We wanted to protect the reassembly, wanted to make sure what we created didn't consist of anything broken, that it was three whole selves with the same hunger. Slater Kinney isn't something you can do half-assed or half-heartedly. We had to really want it, to need it. With no settled version of Slater Kinney, we also required the strength and willingness to push. We knew the entity that is this band would push right back. It always had. The secret was both frightening to keep and empowering to hold. the outcome uncertain, the stakes reset, the expectations high. For now, however, it was just us three, exactly how we wanted it. The first time Janet and Corin and I played music together after 6 years apart was in Corin's basement. It was 2012. Surrounded by Lance's vertiginous and towering archives of magazines and records, we dusted off our own story. The goal on this day was to see if we could write together again, and in order to ease ourselves into the process, we had relearned old songs. In the first iteration of Sleater-Kinney, it had always been a somewhat effortless process for me to recall how to play something when we'd reconvene for an album tour. Muscle memory kicked in, and my fingers found the notes before my brain did. This was true 6 years later as well. What I didn't remember was how it feels to stand in a room while Corin Tucker sings. How her voice is the answer to so many of my questions, a validation, as if she knows the map of my veins. And I had forgotten the beastly avalanche that is Janet Weiss behind the kit, when our guitars are propelled by the cascading force of her. We ran through jumpers, and this time it was not about death, it was about being alive. We would spend the next 2 years writing, telling few people about our plan. In January 2015, Sleater-Kinney put out our first album in a decade. We called it No Cities to Love. Our first show of the tour was in the eastern Washington city of Spokane, where we'd never played before, a small, less visited market. We wanted to begin on the fringes if we could, but that would not be the case. Journalists and photographers flew in. Fans came from as far away as Australia to be there. As we always do about 30 minutes before showtime, we cleared the backstage of friends and crew. Corin and I did vocal warm-ups while Janet drummed on a practice pad. On the outside, I felt confident and happy, but internally I felt something close to disassociation. Our tour manager came to retrieve us, and we walked to the side of the stage. The house lights went off, and I wished I could sit in that blackness, that I could make everything and everyone disappear with a slow-moving blink. I was panicked that I had thrown myself into something I no longer knew how to do, no longer deserved to even be a part of. I was frightened I'd made a horrible mistake. When I looked down, my feet were moving, and I was headed stage right, to the place I've always stood in Sleater-Kinney. That was a start. I knew where to go and where to be. There was a thunderous greeting from the crowd. It was a hello so enormous I could climb inside, and I did. Tears stung my eyes. Corin started the first notes of Price Tag, the opening track on the new album. Two bars later, Janet and I came in. I was in my body, joyous and unafraid. I was home. Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein, and we're going to talk a little bit more about my book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. We've just finished recording the audio version, and now I'm sitting here with our producer and director, Sarah Jaffe, who's going to ask me a few questions, and hopefully I'll answer them.
Hopefully.
To your liking.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. So clearly you're somebody who spent a lot of time in recording studios. What was it like to spend 3 days in a studio recording the audiobook without instruments or bandmates or music?
Well, I think when you get the bill from my therapist, you'll know how it felt. No. Well, I mean, let's be honest, Sarah, we're still here. You're acting like I've had some time to think about it, but technically we're still doing this. Let's see, the first day was difficult because I think... For one, you realize immediately how little you actually read aloud in your life. Certainly we've all read to kids, or most of us have, that's usually about 8 lines per page in like a 24-point font. And I think many of us, when we're reading silently to ourselves, read faster than we would out loud. So there's a bit of a learning curve. And probably similar to the way some people feel when they are first on camera or first on a stage, there's just that kind of intimidation that comes staring at, you know, page after page of words. It was a little challenging at first, and then I really got into the pace and flow of it, and I liked it.
I'm so glad that you did. I really, really liked being in the
studio.
She
just paid me for that answer. She's handing me copious amounts of money.
I'm still handing cash over.
Yeah. Oh, I should add too, in an earnest way, that I do realize the value, I think, of having an audiobook for people that can't, or don't, you know, read, books. So yeah, audiobooks are great, and I listen to them all the time. I think it's a different kind of experience than reading, and an important one.
I'm still handing over cash.
Oh my God, I'm so rich.
So one of the things I noticed while we were recording the book is that you write about music, your own and other people's, in such an incisive and passionate way. And in the book, literature comes up several times as being a big part of your life. And I was just wondering, who are some of your favorite music writers and writers in general?
You know, I haven't read a ton of music books, in terms of like cultural or music criticism. In my early 20s, I read a few biographies. I read the Bessie Smith biography, a Sam Cooke biography. Peter Guralnick is a great music writer. I've read some of Greil Marcus. I like Jessica Hopper. And, I don't know, I read, and so music-wise, I loved like Patti Smith's Just Kids, and I read Bob Dylan's Chronicles. But what I tend to read is more fiction, and I don't know, depending on the day, I feel like there's a lot of different authors I could name. This past year, I really loved Maggie Nelson's Argonauts, which is part memoir, part kind of ontological exploration. It's very philosophical, a little bit academic, but also just beautiful, beautiful writing. And who else did I read? Oh, well, Lauren Groff, Fates and Furies, which will be out by the time people hear this. She is a new author to me, but many people already know her. She's a best-selling author and writes really exciting fiction, and her prose is beautiful. I mean, considering what a page-turner I think she has created, sometimes I actually found myself stumbling, not because it was difficult, but because of the wonder of it over her sentences. But yeah, I don't know. I could name a bunch of authors, but I always feel like it feels so definitive.
I felt that way about Lauren Groff too.
Yeah.
I actually yesterday went to Powell's and I picked up her other two books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Or two of her other books. I don't know if they're the only ones.
So. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And early in the book, you talk about what it is to be a fan. I'm paraphrasing, but you put it something like, to know that loving is better than being beloved. As you've gained your own fan base, are there any artists in any medium that you'd still consider yourself a fan of in that sense today?
Oh, definitely. And actually, authors and writers tend to be people that I look up to the most. I think because it is still so mystifying to me, just the process, even though I am on the other side of having written a book, the process is arduous, and it kind of is amazing to me that there are people that do this over and over again. So I think I've been the most nervous in my life around academics and writers. Like, I remember trapping, well, I didn't trap her, but we were trapped in an elevator, the writer Lori Moore, in New York once, and we were staying at the same hotel and the doors shut, and I thought, oh my God, I'm in the same elevator as Lori Moore. And I really gushed, and then just thought, all she's thinking about is when are these doors going to open and I get to get off and be away from this person. I remember meeting Jeffrey Eugenides or just, you know, anyone. Like, writing is something that I really exalt. And so almost much more than music or film, I nerd out around directors. You know, I met like Matthew Weiner, who created Mad Men. You know, that's such an interesting show. I kind of nerded out around him, or Jill Soloway, who I am fortunate enough to work with on Transparent. I mean, she's just such a brain, you know, just such a smart person. I don't know, intelligence and kindness, the way that those two things intersect. And I guess I'll add innovation. When those things coalesce in art or writing, you know, I can't get enough of it. And that's when I'm definitely going to be pretty nerdy, when I meet someone that does that.
That's a really good answer. I think intelligence and kindness are the two best things anyone can have. I completely agree with you on that.
Yeah, that's where all my crushes are pointed towards, I think. And I mean, I don't just mean romantic, but just that kind of like heart pounding, really excited, you know, motivated towards that energy.
Like an art crush.
An art crush. Yeah.
And actually, that's a good segue to my next question, which is, throughout the book, you mention your friendships with people like Miranda July and Fred Armisen and Eddie Vedder, among others. And I'm just wondering, what do super talented creative powerhouses who also happen to be best friends do when they hang out? Like play cards, go to baseball games, watch movies, and grab drinks like the rest of us?
Oh my gosh, the idea of doing anything involving sports with with Fred or Miranda is laughable. Not because of me, because I am a little bit athletic and coordinated, but I think Fred and Miranda would both admit that neither of them are. Miranda I've known for so many years, and I actually just saw her about 2 days ago. We hang out all the time. What do we do? We sit around and talk. It's a real exchange of ideas, I think. That friendship, it's very mundane on one level. We hang out. She has a beautiful son, and we sometimes just hang out at her house and talk and hang out while he plays. And, you know, other times I drag her to events or vice versa. I think we like observing the world next to each other. But yeah, I don't know. We do all the same normal things. But I really value those friendships a lot. Fred and I just eat a lot of meals together. And we also work together a lot in the summers, especially. So, you know, it can be pretty boring, just us getting our hair and makeup done next to each other and catching up. Yeah, it's all normal, minus the sports. You know what? I need more friends I can go to sporting events with.
So is this a call for all professional athletes who have been wanting to become your friend to come out of the woodwork?
Yes, please.
And if this question is too invasive, you don't have to answer it. But for friendships, like, for example, yours and Miranda's, where you guys were really close before you were so squarely in the public eye, have gaining success and notoriety changed the dynamic of your friendship at all?
I don't think so. I feel like Miranda and I are in a unique position where, one, we're not in direct competition with one another. And I know competition sounds loaded or like a dirty word, and sometimes I think competition is really healthy and it's kind of nice to like to egg each other on and whatnot, but I feel like we've just known each other since we were 19, so I think we've just really enjoyed watching the other person have success and rooting for the other person. I think if anything, my friendship with her has really taught me how to be generous and gracious about someone else's competence and accolades, because you realize, you know, supporting that person is crucial, you know, no matter what is happening in your own life. And I think we've just been really lucky that we've been able to kind of do that side by side. And, yeah, so it really hasn't changed that much, to be honest. I think, it's been gradual and it's been exciting. And I think also you learn to value that what's most important is not the success, you know, in terms of, you know, any monetary success or any even fame, notion of fame, which both Miranda and I think are not super comfortable with or even consider ourselves in that realm. But it's so important to have friendships when you are going through anything that feels surreal. So yeah, she's great.
That's awesome. Portlandia gets a relatively brief shout out in the book.
Yes, it's like one sentence.
And I thought that was interesting because, much to my chagrin as a lifelong Sleater-Kinney fangirl, more and more people are recognizing you from the show rather than your bands. And in the book, you write about having struggled to find a sense of identity during the long Sleater-Kinney hiatus. But with the band touring again and a burgeoning acting career that includes being at the helm of Portlandia, I'm wondering if that has sort of changed your sense of identity and how you reconcile both of them at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a conscious choice not to include Portlandia in the book, for one. I mean, not for anything pointed, just honestly because it seemed like the story sort of ended with Sleater-Kinney, and I kind of wanted to. I'm still sort of in Portlandia, so I don't feel like I quite have the perspective on that yet. But it's true that I think, first of all, Portlandia would never have existed in terms of my participation in it, my ability to collaborate with Fred and to be a writer on the show without Sleater-Kinney, without that whole journey, you know, from a place of uncertainty and insecurity into one of confidence and risk-taking. So I feel like Portlandia exists in the world of this book, kind of in the subtext. The other thing is there are so many aspects of growing up in being in Olympia and things I talk about in the book that to me seem so obviously like precursors to a lot of the things that we end up tackling in Portlandia. And so I think for fans of Portlandia that don't know me through Sleater-Kinney or who don't know any of it but just pick up the book for some reason, the seeds are definitely there. I think I draw on so many of those early experiences in Olympia and with the real, like, esoteric, you know, rigidity of whether it was Riot Girl or a punk scene. And a lot of that stuff turns up in Portlandia. You know, all my relationships to that, to me, feel very present on our show.
Yeah, I was actually watching a couple episodes of the show while I've been in Portland. Mm-hmm. And sort of doing that in conjunction with the book, I was like, that show could also be alternately called Olympialandia.
Yeah, or just even, you know, any of those scenes, and I mean, I talk about this really briefly in the book, but, you know, that sort of claim to be really inclusive, but then when you try to be part of it, it feels highly exclusive and very difficult to navigate what all the rules are. I think you can draw a parallel between those kinds of, like, early punk and indie or, you know, subcultures to, like, the sort of co-op-y, progressive, you know, precious way of being that we live in now. It's like, it's supposed to be this, like, blanket way of living that we all can kind of climb under and feel cozy around, but there's a real prickly underpinning, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl gets into the dirty details of just how gross and grueling and unglamorous touring life is. Have years of touring imbued you with any guilty pleasures or gross habits that carry over into your regular life?
I don't think I have a lot of gross habits because I'm a little bit of a germphobe. I'm not crazy. I'm not OCD, but I feel a sense of pride that I have as someone that's a little bit germphobic. I can at least say that I lived the other way. I slept on disgusting floors. I, you know, took showers in stalls that were covered in mold, like saw tons of stray hairs, and I don't know where they came from, and I don't want to know. I slept in really oily, on really oily bed sheets. You know, I did it all, as is explained in the book. So now I don't feel too guilty about liking a pretty clean hotel room. I travel so much for my work still. And yeah, I like a small level of comfort. It doesn't have to veer into luxury, but it definitely has to be clean. I'm done with the gritty, derelict days of travel. I've definitely done that. I put in my time.
That makes a lot.